Welcome, listeners, for another episode of the Law of Liberty podcast. We have with us Porter.
How's it going, guys?
Great. Thanks for coming on, man. Excited to talk with you again. It's been a little while. It's been a few months.
Yeah, for sure. It has been a few months since I've talked to you, at least, Dave. Talk to Stratty a little bit more.
Yeah, glad to have you. You can find him, Twitter, at Mind Your Excuses. That's a great handle, by the way. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. I came up with it. It was just like a spur of the moment thing that I came up with several years ago now. That it started on Instagram, and then I just kind of migrated the Instagram username to Twitter.
But yeah, it's just great. And he is co-host of the Insurrection Inc. podcast, correct?
That is right. Yep.
Yeah, so you can find them. He does that with Stratty and Jay. So yeah, check them out. It's good stuff. So Porter, we got you on here today to talk about the Enlightenment and the Counter-Enlightenment. Now, I listened to the recent podcast that you did with Cotton on Dissecting Liberty, and that was really, really great. And it reminded me of a lot of the things that I had learned in college, because I took a class on the Enlightenment, and, you know, the Enlightenment's so important. Even if you take a class that's not on the Enlightenment, you're at some point going to talk about someone who was an Enlightenment thinker. There's just so there's just so much there. But I did take one class that was just, this is the Enlightenment, and we're going to talk about this and get into the history, the philosophy and stuff. And so when I heard you on Dissecting Liberty, I was just like, oh yeah, I remember this, and the Counter-Enlightenment, and this, I was just like, I need to go back and look back up on this stuff and get them on and talk about this because I really like it. So I'll give the floor to you just to start. How about you kind of give an overview of what got you interested in this? And the kind of class that you took, and can you, I know it's very difficult, but give like a broad kind of overview of the Enlightenment and what was kind of going on there.
Yeah, for sure. So the class I took that I wrote this paper for that I originally went and talked about on Dissecting Liberty with Cotton, the class was, it's an English class. I think it's English 283 or whatever at my university. And it was called The Enlightenment and Its Discontents. And so it was a broad overview. We didn't go specifically into like the politics of the Enlightenment or the epistemology of the Enlightenment, any like specific topics like that. It was just a broad overview of a lot of the literature that came out of that period, and some of the literature from contemporary thinkers like from that period as well, who were not so satisfied with the Enlightenment and kind of what those philosophers were thinking. That so we went over some of the countercurrents to the main contributors of the Enlightenment as well. And so, yeah, this paper that I wrote was about the politics of the Enlightenment, but it was just because that's kind of my personal interest. Obviously, I'm interested in politics. That's why we're all here. And so that's what I wrote about. But yeah, that's where that class was coming from. It was just a broad overview, and it was kind of a gateway for me to explore more into what I was interested in already.
Yeah. So how familiar were you with Enlightenment ideas before taking the class? Had you taken a class on it before? Was it something you were already doing some research in?
Yeah, so I hadn't actually taken a class on it before, but I did know at least kind of what the Enlightenment was. I knew like the important people out of there, Kant, Smith, you know, several other ones. Montague is often thrown in there, Wollstonecraft. And so I knew like some of the big people, I knew some of the big ideas, but I hadn't really read a whole lot of it. It was more like secondhand knowledge. And this class was a great way for me to be introduced to some of the primary sources, like actually reading not just The Wealth of Nations from Adam Smith, which we actually did read a few excerpts from in that class, but also his Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was, at least in his own time, equally important among kind of the intellectual classes of the time, although Wealth of Nations has obviously had more of an impact long term, I would say. At least it's more discussed now. But so getting to read some more sources like that, also read Kant's famous essay, What is Enlightenment?, which was really interesting to me. It's also extremely short. I recommend anyone who's interested in this stuff, even a little bit, go read it, because it'll take you 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, stuff like that. And that was my first introduction to actually reading the material of the Enlightenment. And I wouldn't say I'm an expert on it or anything, obviously, but I do know it a lot better now. And it did pique my interest in some areas that I'd like to keep exploring.
Yeah, that short tract by Kant is really great. Kant's definitely a guy who, over the years for me, I've come to like more than I originally did, because I came out of Ayn Rand from the beginning, and it was like, oh, Kant's the bad guy. And I'm just like, oh, okay. And then I read him more, and I'm like, what? This is fine. You know, I mean, obviously, yeah. he's wrong on some things, but, you know, he's not this devilish fiend that she kind of made him out to be. And part of that was just misinterpretation of his epistemology, I think. But we just recently did an episode with Cotton. He came on, and we talked about Nietzsche and that kind of train that he's been on lately. And that turned into what we ended up talking a little bit about postmodernism and other things like that. And I would kind of like to get to that in the end, because forgive me if I don't remember, but when you were on Dissecting Liberty, you were talking about the counter enlightenment, but did you at all tie it in with postmodernism at all when you were talking about it there?
So we did. I discussed a little bit. One of the names that we discussed the most was Isaiah Berlin,
right.
which you said on Twitter you've done some reading of his work.
Yeah.
I don't know how much reading you've done, but he was one of the big counter-Enlightenment guys of the 20th century who took kind of a revisionist approach to these Enlightenment thoughts, specifically Enlightenment liberalism, which was not the only, certainly, but one of the main political strains of thought to come out of the Enlightenment. And Berlin, there's kind of a fight over him among current philosophers, whether he was a postmodernist or not. It's like some of the postmodernists claim him, some of his defenders say he wasn't a postmodernist, he wouldn't have gone that far, he wouldn't have labeled himself that. He died in 1995, so, and postmodernism was around by then, but it's gaining even more traction since then. It's been gaining more traction since then. And so that conversation's kind of developed in his absence, and unfortunately, he never really commented on it as far as I know. Never really said whether he would label himself a postmodernist or not. And he was a Latvian-born British philosopher, so and the postmodernists were largely French, so that was kind of geographically separate, too. He wasn't really part of that movement, but some people like to claim that he was a postmodernist philosophically, and some say he wasn't. And so, yeah, Cotton and I kind of got into talking about that dispute, but we didn't really talk about postmodernism in depth beyond that. Yeah.
All right, cool. So I would like to try to get to that later in the episode, but first we should try to just kind of talk about the Enlightenment a bit, because in order to understand the counter Enlightenment, you got to know what was the Enlightenment. I mean, what are these guys so angry about? Here, let's I wrote down a brief one sentence definition of the Enlightenment from, you know, just reading over my notes from the class, and I want to see if this is something that in your understanding you agree with. I would define the Enlightenment as pushing forward the proposition, and you mentioned this too in Dissecting Liberty, that there are different factions in the Enlightenment. There were the French, mm-hmm. there were the Germans, the English, the Scottish. So, you know, there's no real single unifying thing with this Enlightenment beyond a very broad stroke. And I think that the way to kind of put it is that the Enlightenment stands for the position that mankind can use reason to understand the world and ourselves. So we can understand human nature, we can understand the nature of the world, and therefore we can leverage that to become better, more moral, to become smarter, more educated, and to become wealthier, to have more control over the physical world and to live life better. Do you think that's a fair, broad description of what's going on with the Enlightenment?
Yeah, I would say that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what I would call the Enlightenment as a whole movement, if it, you know, to the extent that it was a monolithic movement. Because like you said, there are different parts, but they did share at least some core strains of thought, some core themes, and I think you nailed it, yeah.
Great. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just kind of take a minute to set the scene, as it were, because you said that in your class you didn't specifically get into the epistemology and that kind of stuff. The class that I took when I was a senior back a few years ago got heavily into that, and reading it over, I was just looking at it, I'm just like, you know, this is really kind of important. So I'd kind of like to throw this kind of, you know, historical, philosophical kind of overview of the stage of the Enlightenment, and then turn it back to you and get your thoughts on it. Is that cool with you?
Yeah, that works for me. I would like to add one more thing that I should have mentioned. I talked about the Kant essay, What is Enlightenment? And that was written in I don't know when it was written. It was published in 1789. It was published a few years after it was written. I don't know the exact year. But, you know, right in the middle of it, right in the thick of the Enlightenment and just prior to the French Revolution, which was this huge, there's some debate over it, obviously. There's a lot of debate over it. But it's generally seen as an Enlightenment political movement, for better or for worse.
Right.
And so Kant is writing on the eve of that. And obviously, the essay is called What is Enlightenment? So he attempts to define it. And he defines it more personally. I think your definition is correct as a defining it as a movement, but he's defining it before it can be even considered a whole literary movement. Like, it's only considered a movement in hindsight. Kant was defining enlightenment in the literal sense of the word. And he says, and this is important, I think we'll come back to it eventually, he says that enlightenment is mankind's emergence from his self-incurred minority. And that's a translation from the original German-Prussian writing. And by minority, he just means basically immaturity or the inability to think for oneself, essentially. You have to be guided by others who can think. And so minority is often translated as immaturity or other words, but that's the definition. I like that definition as a definition of the word enlightenment itself.
Yeah. Minority is a term of art in law that just basically means below the age of adulthood, basically, you know. So United States, it's usually 18, and if you're under 18, you're considered below the age of majority. So that's that's just kind of a term of art, and I'm sure there's some linguistic thing that goes back to, you know, what you were saying with the translation with Kant and why that would be the word used. So for people who don't know, that's what that means. But yeah, I do like that. I do like that definition as well. Like you said, it's more personal, and it's basically just saying enlightenment is the ability to think for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. He said, I love this. I want a poster with it. I'm probably going to design one for the Insurrection Inc. Teespring store eventually. But he says the motto of enlightenment should be sapere aude, which is Latin for dare to be wise, dare to think for oneself. Yeah. And I really like that. Kant wasn't perfect, like you said. He did get some things wrong, but for all he got wrong, I think he gets that right. And I absolutely love that quote.
Yeah.
Which he stole from Horace, I believe.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't the first one to say it, but he did popularize sapere aude.
For sure. All right. So let's set the scene here. So what was going on with the Enlightenment was the scientific revolution preceded the Enlightenment. So we have Copernicus, Francis Bacon. They were writing before the Enlightenment really kind of took off. If I remember correctly, Copernicus made his theory of the solar centric system of the solar system was 1550s, 1560s, mid late 1600s. Then Bacon comes along in the early 17th century, and I believe it was 1620, he has the new science, the Novum Organum. And that was when he puts forth his idea of empiricism, inductive reasoning. We have to go out into the world and collect data, and that's the basis of our knowledge and how we can figure things out. So Bacon was kind of the big first guy on the scientific method. The idea of inductive reasoning and data collection and all that is a very anti-rationalistic approach, right? Where as a guy like Descartes is like, no, we don't need to like go out and collect data. We just kind of think about it, and we have these principles that we go through, and we can just logic this out and have a full first philosophy. And this is the structuralist, rationalist view that was big in the Enlightenment. And as you go through the Enlightenment, we see a lot of, you know, we see this kind of empiricism versus rationalism, right? We have rationalists like Descartes. I don't even know if Descartes is considered an Enlightenment thinker. I think he's kind of like late medieval pre-Enlightenment.
Right. Yeah. He's a little bit early to be considered Enlightenment. But I mean, even Locke is considered like the beginning of the Enlightenment, pretty much, at least in England. And he was late 17th century. So maybe Descartes can be included in there.
Yeah. I would include Descartes in there because he's that big rationalist push that goes forward. And then we see that in other kind of people, you know, after him. I mean, guys like guys like Barclay and other kind of things who were very rationalistic and idealistic and took the mind-body dichotomy, right? So what was also going on was, even back all the way to the Greeks, there was the long line of skeptic philosophers. People who were like, we can't have knowledge for sure. Everything is contingent, right? And this skepticism kind of fits in with the scientific revolution, right? Because science is just like, well, we have this hypothesis, we collect the data, we update it, validate or invalidate it, but we never know anything for sure. And that's mm-hmm. typified in the 20th century with Popper, Karl Popper. He's the big guy there. So, but it all kind of goes back to Bacon to start. And then, so we have the scientific revolution and we have the skepticism, which are kind of right at the beginning of all this. Descartes tries to bring it back in the rationalism and say, no, we got to keep it just reason and logic. And then, so there was this guy, Pierre Bayle, who was a French philosopher, and he was this big skeptic, and he was really honing in on the skepticism during the Enlightenment. And Bayle was a big influence on Hume. And I'm also glad that you talked about Locke, because Locke was an empiricist, and he was mm-hmm. he was the guy who was like, tabula rasa, we're born with a blank slate of the mind, and everything that comes into our mind is based on experience and things we perceive. And that really influenced Hume. And Hume was also influenced by Bayle, the skeptic. So Hume is this skeptic empiricist who,
right.
Right, exactly. And so we're seeing in the Enlightenment even this fighting between rationalism and empiricism and skepticism, but all of it is reason. All of it is saying we have to use reason to understand what the method of using the reason is there's differences there, but reason itself is still kind of the unifying thing. And I think, you know, when we get later into the postmodernists, and this is kind of my personal criticism of postmodernism, is that just because the reason that these other guys were trying to implement, just because it wasn't, they didn't totally get it right, they come to some wrong conclusions, doesn't mean that the importance of reason and that kind of method needs to be thrown out entirely.
Right.
So I don't want to railroad you. So just what are your kind of thoughts on that? This kind of first kind of this epistemological tug of war that's kind of going on in the Enlightenment.
Yeah, I actually hadn't heard the name Bayle before, so that's interesting. We're gonna have to look that up. You said Pierre Bayle, right?
That is right. And this also comes from Montaigne too. Montaigne was writing in the 1600s in his essay, 16th century with his essays, and he was just like, cultural relativism, skepticism, we can't know anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because you see kind of the roots of postmodernism already here.
Right.
But it kind of, first it blends into the Enlightenment with people like Hume. So yeah, I do like that overview. And Hume's always a fascinating figure to me. We read a lot of Hume this semester. Actually, I didn't mention his name earlier, but we read a lot of Hume. And he's somebody, like, if I could bring him back to observe 2020, I would. Like, I want to hear his thoughts. Like, David Hume with a Twitter account, he'd be the type to write, like, 30 tweet threads, but still, it'd be fun to hear him. And so, yeah, it is interesting seeing that tug of war between empiricism and rationalism come together. But like you said, reason is the binding thread here. And what's interesting about the Enlightenment is, even though it has its roots in this kind of this skepticism, like with Hume, it still overall, like in your definition, comes to the conclusion that through reason and applying reason to our observations of the world, it's not necessarily anti-empiricist, but through reason we can improve ourselves, improve society, make ourselves wealthier, make ourselves smarter. Make everything more efficient. That's one view. That's more of a specific political application, but that's one view that comes out of it. And so as this relates to the politics of the Enlightenment, in one strain, we get people like Adam Smith, and then that leads down to more of the liberal economists like Karl Menger later, and then even Mises, and the ideas aren't perfectly transmitted. Mises wasn't a perfect Enlightenment liberal. He didn't have all the same beliefs as, say, John Locke or something. Obviously, he does change up some things, but kind of the core thought is there. But also out of the Enlightenment, because of this core thread of reason, you get people who believe that they can, that if we put the smart people in charge, we can use reason to organize all of the unthinking masses who are still in minority, basically. And that's the thing with Hume, too. That's why I like that essay so much, is I don't think he's wrong in that essay. Like, I generally agree with his assessment and his definition of Enlightenment. And yet it lends itself incredibly well to all types of authoritarianism.
Right.
Because he mentions that the people who escape their self-incurred minority first become basically the guardians, this guardian class, because they can think for themselves while everyone else is still in this self-incurred minority, as he defines it, and they're not ready to think for themselves yet. And I'm kind of getting ahead here, but there's this guy named Jacobi, who is a German classical liberal, and his criticism of Kant was basically, or his criticism of the Enlightenment is basically this problem that arises from Kant's essay, which is, who are the guardians going to be, and what incentive do they have to ever give up their position as guardians? Because once you attain guardian status, Kant's view was kind of, they could guide the rest of society to eventually leave minority as well. But the problem with power is that there's no incentive to give it up once you have it. And so these guardian classes in reality end up promoting kind of a false enlightenment, basically. And I don't know if it was Jacobi who said this or someone else, but basically they want, he's criticizing some of the authoritarian governments of the 20th century, and he says they want to promote an enlightenment everywhere but in the mind, because that takes too long. As in, it takes too long to actually teach people to truly think for themselves, to sapere aude, dare to be wise. And instead, we can just kind of force them to go along with the smart people who can, supposedly at least, think for themselves. And the smart people will just organize society rationally and efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the huge anti-liberal strain that also comes out of the Enlightenment. That's the huge problem that the counter-Enlightenment liberals identified.
Right, right. So epistemology it's so crucial to recognize and understand what we can know, what we can't know, and how do we know what we know. And that ties in with what you're saying about this enlightened despotism, where these people know how to organize things. And with these dueling epistemologies of the Enlightenment, the beautiful thing about Mises that I think is that he squared the circle between the two, because he adopts the methodological dualism, which is something we've talked about on our show before, where he's basically like, you know, Bacon, Hume, they're right when it comes to causal things. They're right when it comes to scientific method, understanding physics, the cosmos, and that kind of stuff. But then he's fully Kantian rationalist when it comes to the human realm, to the teleological realm, the realm of consciousness and action and thought. And so Mises, this liberal who's coming out in the 20th century and doing his work, really kind of takes both of these Enlightenment strains and blends them together, which I think is a fantastic step forward for the social sciences and epistemology, philosophy generally.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then still, though, I would consider Mises an Enlightenment liberal, which was kind of the part of the argument I made in my paper that I wrote for this class. And like I said, he's not a perfect Enlightenment liberal. He doesn't share all the same ideas, because one of the main things as part of the Enlightenment was, at least in the English Enlightenment, was this idea of natural rights. You get first from John Locke, and then Wollstonecraft a little bit, and also Thomas Paine. They all have this idea of the natural rights of man, and Mises rejected that entirely. Rothbard kind of brings it back, but not exactly from the same philosophical foundations, but Mises doesn't believe in natural rights. He's very explicit about that in his book Liberalism, and so that's one thing. But then in other ways, he's very much an Enlightenment liberal. This opposition to monarchy is one. Like I said, Hoppe, like I said in the Dissecting Liberty podcast, Hoppe kind of changes that up later, even though philosophically he does. He's very friendly with people like Locke and the natural rights argument.
See, that was my paper that I wrote for my class. The final paper was basically, my thing was just, hey, we've got this Enlightenment with this structuralist method and this rationalism, but then we also have these counter Enlightenment conclusions of pro-democracy, not pro-monarchy, anti-democracy, anti-egalitarianism, some of those. Because the Enlightenment was really trying to get universals. They were trying to universalize everything. And so they wanted universal rights. They wanted universal this and that for politics and society. So they thought that, okay, well, universal suffrage means democracy and all this. And then Hoppe is just like, no, like, you think you're getting these universals, but you're not at all. You're creating class conflict. You're creating exploiters and exploited with voting and politics and democracy. So that was my paper, how Hoppe uses the Enlightenment approach, but he comes to some counter Enlightenment outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. That's why he's so interesting as a thinker. Just one reason he's so interesting as a thinker. And yeah, he uses the Enlightenment approach. That's just fascinating to me. I could write a whole paper just on that, I think. I might at some point, just for fun.
Yeah.
It's also funny, I should add, my professor is a Marxist, or was a Marxist. The semester's over now.
Yeah.
To his credit, he never really brought it in to the class. He was pretty, liberal towards us and what we could write about and what approaches we could take. He knew from the beginning that I was pretty Austrian leaning, he was very open to whatever we wanted to write about on this paper, and so I actually used, we had to cite a certain number of sources. There was like a required number to cite in this paper, and Hoppe was one of them, and like I was wondering how he would react to that, but I got nearly a perfect score on the paper, and he had very high praise for it. So, you know, credits to him. There aren't many Marxist professors that aren't incredibly biased anymore.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of Marxist professors, but not many who would react that well to something like this.
Yeah.
So shout out.
Yeah, I remember at the same time when I was taking the class when I was a senior, I was taking a 18th, 19th century German thought class, and we were reading Marx and Nietzsche, Freud. And he was explicitly Marxist, and he was just openly hostile to libertarians in class. And I was just like, dude, I mean, you can think what you want to think, but like, please have some integrity. Don't be rude and recognize that you might have students who disagree with you, and you can't just be a dick in class.
I went into it expecting that and was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
But I do want to go back to, you said the Enlightenment was always searching for universals, and that's because they basically thought that through reason we could get to universal truth, and from there we could derive practical applications of it, which often led to things like universal suffrage, universal democracy. And part of the problem with universal truth is when it's combined with kind of this Kantian vision of the guardian class, you get, again, this enlightened despotism, which is that other main political strain that comes out of Enlightenment thought. And that's when, I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence Kant was Prussian, and the modern public education system is based largely off of the Prussian system.
Yeah.
Kant didn't have any specific influence in that, as far as I know. But certainly the geographical connections are there, I think.
Yeah.
And what essentially the public schooling project is, that started with the Prussian project, was to instill universal truth in the youth by force if necessary.
Right.
Because that's what public schools are.
And that also ties in with Rousseau and Condorcet as well, because Rousseau was all about public education. I mean, I think Rousseau was, in Social Contract, he was pretty Platonist, at least in the sense of, you know, Plato was like, you have a kid and then then they're taken away from you, and they're raised by somebody else, and the public education. Rousseau was all about that, and Condorcet as well. Condorcet was very liberal, very free market, you know, not necessarily an egalitarian in the sense of distribution of wealth and talents and stuff, but he was an egalitarian in the sense of suffrage and public education. So that's interesting to me because Condorcet kind of represents a kind of a middle ground between Rousseau and Smith, I think, because he was very free market and liberal like Smith, but then he was also very kind of, you know, quasi-egalitarian and pro-public education like Rousseau. So that's just another interesting point of how we see these different people blending with each other, and one guy's kind of a middle ground between these two, but they're all part of the same swath of history. It's very interesting.
Right. Yeah, I haven't read any Condorcet. I know of him, but I haven't read him. We did read a good bit of Rousseau this semester, in particular his Discourse on Inequality. That's what we read, mainly from him. We read a few other excerpts, but I hated that, to be honest. Yeah. I don't like Rousseau very much at all.
Yeah, competition is bad, and we need to all be... Right. We all need savages in nature.
Right, yeah, the noble savage. I think Smith absolutely demolishes Rousseau on those arguments. I am a big fan of Smith, despite some things he got wrong. I know Rothbard. I own Rothbard's History of Economic Thought from an Austrian Perspective. Haven't read it yet. Got a long list of books I need to read.
Yeah.
But I know in the first volume of that, he goes pretty hard on Smith, but I can't help but like him just for being, he was revolutionary in his own right, even when he was wrong. He was wrong in interesting ways. And so, yeah, I'm not a big fan of Rousseau vis-a-vis Smith.
The great thing about Smith was you mentioned this before, how he was a professor of ethics. That was his discipline. In Scotland. What university was he at? I can't remember.
I don't know. Yeah. Glasgow, I think.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was an ethical philosopher who writes this economic tract and releases it in 1776. And it's interesting how he says it is not the goodwill of the butcher, the baker, the candle maker that he gives you his wares. It's his selfish desire to you know, make a profit or whatever. And that leads to good outcomes through mutually beneficial exchange. And that's very anti-Kant, because for Kant, the only good thing in itself is a good will. So Kant doesn't care about outcomes kind of at all. He just cares, was your will good? And then Smith is like, no, your will doesn't matter at all, right? Mm-hmm. When we have the market process, you know, there's mutually beneficial things there. So, you know, you see in Smith the starting down the road to like subjective theory of value, which he flubbed because of his labor theory of value, which directly led to Marxism and that kind of thing. But it is interesting to see how these Enlightenment people, just ethics, epistemology, there is so much divergence here. So that's why sometimes I think that calling this period the Enlightenment, I mean, it makes sense and it helps to chop history up into epochs, but I mean, there's just so much diversity of thought here. It is kind of dumb to try to chalk a single label on all of this,
right? Like calling it the Enlightenment as if it's one thing is kind of misleading.
I think the age of Enlightenment might be better term.
Yeah, well, that's another interesting part. Is Kant also addresses the question in his essay of whether he lives in an enlightened age or an age of enlightenment. And he says, we don't live in an enlightened age. We live in an age of enlightenment, because, and this is my words, I'm kind of paraphrasing him, but he says, basically his view is that enlightenment is a process. And so to live in an age of enlightenment is when it's still ongoing. People are still making their way out of their self-incurred minority, in his words. And to be in an enlightened age means everyone can already think for themselves. There's no need for a guardian class anymore. Everyone is equally capable of thinking for themselves. And so one of the questions we were asked by our professor this semester in a smaller assignment was, do we now live in an age of enlightenment or an enlightened age? And I wasn't sure whether we lived in either one. I kind of wanted to answer no to both of those. I don't actually remember what I specifically said. I certainly don't think we live in an enlightened age.
No.
But maybe an age of enlightenment. Who knows? And so it's interesting that you mentioned that term, because Kant does tackle that one, or try to tackle that one too.
I'd like to believe we're living in an age of enlightenment.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of disheartening if we weren't.
Right. Although it's been about almost 250 years since Kant wrote that, 230-ish years.
Yeah.
And slow and steady. Be in an age of enlightenment. Yeah, this yeah. takes a while.
Huh? Yeah, for sure. So, I just have a few more points on kind of the epistemology thing that I want to just put out there, and then we'll see where it leads us. The really cool thing about Descartes, what he did, we were talking about him before with the rationalism, but he took skepticism and flipped it on itself, right? In the Meditations, he's like, okay, I'm just going to assume I know nothing. Full skepticism. I know absolutely nothing. And I know that if I know nothing, and that this is the evil demon hypothetical, right? He says, if there's an evil demon deceiving me, and everything I see, everything I perceive is a fiction, is not true. Well, I know that I have to exist, because if I didn't exist, I couldn't be deceived. So even if I adopt 100% full skepticism, I can still know from adopting that I exist. And that's his first point, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I exist. And so that's like a beautiful sleight of hand that Descartes did, where he's like, hey, skeptics, even if you go full skeptic, there's still this universal truth that we can get to. So I think that in itself, I don't agree with everything in Descartes. And I think he did try to take rationalism too far, because he tried to rationalize the theory of the cosmos and physics and mm-hmm. all this stuff. And it doesn't work. And Newton came later. Newton wrote after Descartes, and Newton synthesized Bacon and the empirical scientific stuff with Descartes, where Newton is like, yeah, we need to have general laws of motion and energy and stuff, but the specifics we have to do testing and figure things out. So Newton kind of represents a blending of Descartes and Bacon, which is very interesting. Yeah, we see in the Enlightenment where things are becoming much more personal, and you kind of mentioned that before with Kant, with free thinking and getting rid of self-incurred minority. All the old style philosophy, like back to Aristotle and Socrates, they were like metaphysicians. They were trying to come up with first principles to explain basically everything. And then in the Enlightenment, we see this big shift to focusing more on epistemology rather than focusing on what's the nature of reality. We're focusing on what's the nature of our knowledge and our understanding of reality.
Yeah, what's the nature of inquiry?
Right, and that's a huge step too, because that's a middle step. Because once you go from looking at metaphysics to epistemology, then you go from epistemology to psychology, and that's when we get Nietzsche and Freud in the 19th in the 19th century. And then, as we were saying before, you know, Nietzsche, we mentioned this with Cotton. Nietzsche is kind of, in some people's minds, the first postmodernist and the first psychologist. So we can see this even in the most rationalistic, even in the most reasoned people, we can see this train where they're going towards this kind of start of postmodernism, which is very fascinating, because the postmodernism kind of links with the counter enlightenment. So it's interesting.
More interesting, because not all of the counter enlightenment philosophers, especially not the counter-enlightenment liberals, would necessarily consider themselves postmodernists.
Right.
I think they would have some disagreements, and yet they're kind of inextricably linked anyway.
Right. Well, it's kind of a horseshoe theory kind of thing, because the postmodernists are generally considered to be on the political left, but the original counter-enlightenment people, like De Maistre was writing right after the French Revolution. He was writing during the French Revolution, actually,
yeah,
during the Reign of Terror. And he was like, guys, look what you're doing. Like, you,
right.
You're hubris, right? That was a big thing for them, hubris, believing that you could know everything, the rejection of religion, mm-hmm. the rejection of tradition, culture. And De Maistre is like, look, your freedom doesn't mean anything if you're dead. And we're falling into disorder and chaos. And, you know, France might not even be France if we keep going down this road.
Yeah. And there's so many places you can go with that line of thought, because I do tend to agree with a lot of what De Maistre says, and like, yeah, I find him a very interesting thinker as well, even though he's more of like what we'd now call the old right. He was kind of a right wing counter enlightenment in every sense of the word,
right.
Counter enlightenment in both the political and philosophical sense. And So what's interesting is one of the things he abhors the most is this disorder and chaos. And Mises does the same thing from kind of a more Enlightenment perspective, not total Enlightenment, but a more Enlightenment perspective. Mises hates disorder and chaos too, but he sees state like socialist planning as ultimate economic chaos. It's not enforced order. It's chaos in the highest order because there's no calculation. So he brings, the economic reasoning into it, but sees it the same way. And a lot of the things he defends politically, like Mises does defend representative democracy, but he says he defends it not on egalitarian grounds like some of the Enlightenment philosophers. He defends it because he says it's the best way to guarantee the peaceful transition of political power, which, you can argue, but at least his reason for supporting democracy is pretty strong and aligns with basically what de Maistre wants too. Right.
That's another amazing thing about Mises is how he showed that the totalitarian state, the state controlled economy, that is disorder. It's imposed disorder. Yeah. And so it's this beautiful, I won't call it a contradiction, but at least a paradox, on its face of the full freedom, full liberty, the free market is what allows for order. And that also is addressing de Maistre's point, because de Maistre was like, you hubris, you think you know everything. And then Mises is like, you're right, we don't know everything. And that's why we need the market to disperse knowledge throughout the economy, reflected in prices, so that everybody can take advantage of other people's knowledge and other people's subjective values without having to know them all. And so that's a beautiful, beautiful update that Mises gives that's directly out of this Enlightenment, counter-Enlightenment battle.
Yeah, and Smith kind of starts that as well. He kind of gets there. Obviously, Mises is much more well-developed, but Smith kind of does understand that too with his invisible hand metaphor and things like that. He kind of understands this like order out of freedom idea. And it's also interesting because Mises doesn't take total skepticism either, kind of taking a play out of Descartes' playbook. He says, you're right, we don't know everything, but we know enough to know that this imposed disorder can't work. We know that if it's imposed, it is going to be disorder and chaos, and there's no calculation. We know that's not going to work. We don't know everything, but we know enough to know that we have to have freedom and property in order to come to, he calls it, rational market conclusions.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think we're getting to the point where we can kind of transfer fully into the counter-Enlightenment and talk about that, but the big thing was that the Enlightenment destroyed a lot. The Enlightenment ripped up these roots and hacked at the base of so much of philosophy and so much of society at the time. And, part of that was religion. In the Enlightenment, we see a big increase in hostility towards religion with guys like Voltaire.
Even Hume was an atheist, which was extremely controversial for his time.
Yeah. And even a guy like Locke, who was very, very religious, and his entire social theory was based on like the idea that God gives the world to man in common and, da-da-da. Mm-hmm. He was very religious, and he believed that Christianity was the one true faith. But he even had unorthodox religious views that were a little controversial in his time. So it's kind of interesting how even the religious people at the time are beginning to tweak their views of it. Even Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson had interesting views on religion. He was more of like a deist.
Yeah, a lot of the founders and even like Adam Smith could be kind of qualified as this, although he wasn't too open about his religious beliefs. A lot of them were deists, like you said.
Yeah.
Kind of not the orthodox Christian view of God, but more of like the clockmaker God, kind of set the world in motion. Like they had a belief in a supreme being, but not an interventionist one.
Right. So, and that was a view of the Holbach and Lemaître. They were like, oh, the world is like a clock, right? Like God put whatever in order, even if they didn't believe in God or whatever, or if they did believe in God, they were like, he just kind of set things in motion, and then it's just matter and energy mechanics and everything. And so then that gets into the issue of free will and determinism, because free will was I know even before there was arguments and stuff within Christianity, guys like Calvin, and I think even St. Augustine believed in predetermination, or I could be wrong there. But, you know, guys like
Calvin. That sounds right to me.
Yeah, guys like Calvin, especially, he's the big one who believed that there's predetermination. But beyond that, Christianity in general was very, you know, idea of free will. And free will was huge for guys like Kant, and that because their ethics, they were like, if you don't have free will, there's no ethics, right? Because
right, exactly.
Everything is just predetermined. There's no accountability for your actions. And we talked about this last time with Cotton talking about Nietzsche, because Nietzsche was a full determinist. And for us, you know, trying to hone in things, you know, talk about philosophy and stuff with an eye to implications for law, that's huge, because the entire Western legal system is based on the idea of culpability for your own actions. Mm-hmm. And so if everything's predetermined, you know, well, can we have law, or can we have criminal justice at all? Can we have any of this stuff that our entire social order is based on? And I think we can, even if metaphysically everything's predetermined, I still think that can be justified. And I make that case in the last episode. I won't reiterate it here. But it's interesting how it's Locke and Hume were the big ones there who really kind of took that step towards the death of the idea of free will, because Locke was just like, everything in your mind is just based on impressions that you see. And he collapsed the mind-body dichotomy together, whereas Descartes had the mind and body split, and Locke and Hume were like, no, they are together, they're one thing. And then with the scientific revolution, it's like, well, are we just like stars? You know, is everything we think and do just predetermined? And the Enlightenment saw a big growth in that view that everything's predetermined. And I think that also plays into the enlightened despotism thing, and the idea of, like, first of all, you could justify it as, well, the king's the king, he's here, and everything's predetermined, so that's it. Like, it's justified because this is the way things are. But it also goes into the idea of, we can know everything, and we can understand how these mechanics work, and so we're the ones who are kind of the stewards, in a sense, of pushing all of this forward. So I think that's an important point, is how the Enlightenment is hacking at the base of this idea of free will. We also talked about religion. Oh, and then the last point is the idea of the individual, because this is another kind of tug of war that's going on too, because we're talking about universals and, you know, universal suffrage, equality, egalitarianism, but then also this idea of natural rights, of individualism, and then Locke has, you know, personal property, private property with his Lockean proviso. It's kind of interesting how the idea of the individual and what the individual is went under modifications during the Enlightenment, because Descartes is like, well, the individual in thought is primary. And then Locke and Hume are like, no, there is no individual, because you're always changing with every impression you get. So there is no identity, there is no ego, right? Whereas Descartes is like, no, I know that I'm here. And then, you know, that's consciousness versus series of impressions, the stable identity versus ever-changing, the self is real, the self is an illusion. And that's what Hume thought. Hume thought that the self is an illusion. So that's an interesting thing here, because I think that leads into very, what we would call anti-liberal political outcomes of socialism, collectivism, you know, trying to universalize everything and get this full kind of view.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, just a couple of hours ago today, there was some like 12 follower communist account. It was probably a bait, to be honest, but saying that if we discard the idea of individual agency, individual concerns being the primary concern, like the highest goal or highest end, then communism works, because there's no more social calculation problem. It's just whatever the planners decide is society's highest goal, and that's it. That's the end all be all. Yeah. And I just responded, I was like, I hope some communists daringly try this very far, far away from me. And I'd be happy with that. I hope it works out for them.
See what happens. You're on the sidelines.
Yeah, but like the roots of that thought are exactly what you're talking about.
All right, great. So let's. Yeah. Sorry. What are you gonna say?
I was just going to say, which is fascinating because Hume obviously was not a communist. He was at least economically pretty similar to Adam Smith. They were buddies. So
I think he even had some like anarchist tendencies. He wrote a little bit about about that.
I mean, he wrote a little bit about economics. He was mainly a philosopher, more so than Adam Smith was. Obviously, Adam Smith took a lot more time to write on economics, even though he also was a professor of moral philosophy and ethics. But yeah, Hume had plenty of economic contributions of his own and a few essays scattered here and there, and he was very liberal economically as well.
Yeah, so let's just a brief overview of liberalism, because I think we've gotten to the point where we can just kind of dive into what is liberalism, right? Like, what if you could define it briefly, like, what is the liberalism that comes out of the Enlightenment? How can we kind of view that?
Let's see. So the liberalism, this goes back to talking about how there are different strains of the Enlightenment, like different, it's not a monolithic movement at all, different parts of the Enlightenment, because certain Enlightenment liberals, like especially the English ones, Thomas Paine, John Locke, Wollstonecraft, those, the core of their liberalism was a belief in equal natural rights for all people, which led to some forms of egalitarianism, especially in Wollstonecraft. Like her, she's considered the first feminist as well, in a lot of circles, at least in the English speaking world. She's pretty much the first feminist, and that came out of this same idea of equal rights. So for that part of the Enlightenment, Enlightenment liberalism is a belief in certain natural rights of all people, and everyone has the same natural rights regardless of how they were born or their stature in society or whatever. And that led to very, very strong attacks on things like the principle of divine right, which was used to justify monarchy. Because if we all have equal natural rights, why does that person get to be a king and this person has to be a peasant? And like, why does that person just deserve power? So that was an attack on divine right. But then other strains of Enlightenment liberalism were more like the Scottish version of Adam Smith. He doesn't concern himself so much with talking about whether people have natural rights or not. He's talking about the way to organize society so that it's the most productive, and that we, to build the wealth of nations. That's why the book is named what it is. It's the full title is An Inquiry into the Causes and Nature of the Wealth of Nations. And so he's trying to figure out why some places are poor and some places are rich and how they got that way. And his liberalism determines that basically freedom, free market, with some aberrations because he's Smith and he doesn't have everything figured out yet. But basically, the free market and private property is the best way to organize society so that we have these good outcomes that we want. And so largely he comes to the same political conclusions as the other Enlightenment liberals, because their natural rights theory leads them to believe that freedom is good, but for other reasons. They're not concerned with the economics so much. And so there's not a monolithic Enlightenment liberalism, which is where some of its issues come from as well, some of its shortcomings or weaknesses. But those would be kind of the two definitions, I think. That was a very long-winded explanation.
No.
I think that sums it up.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And yeah, it is interesting to see the difference. You got your natural rights guys like Locke, Condorcet, like you mentioned, Wollstonecraft, Kant too. I mean, I don't know if Kant was necessary. I guess you could consider Kant a natural rights theorist.
Yeah, I don't even know. I don't actually know his position on that stuff, but he did at least favor democracy on somewhat egalitarian grounds. He thought it would also lead to like infinite world peace as well, which is not exactly played out.
Yeah,
as he envisioned.
I think one of his things was separation of powers, and that's kind of a similarity between him and Montesquieu, who Montesquieu was of course really influential. I mean, I think Montesquieu and Locke were the two ones who influenced the founders probably more than almost any of these Enlightenment liberals. Yeah, Kant was just kind of like, well, you need a legislature and an executive who are separate, and the king can be the sole legislature. That's fine, but he should have sub executives under him who enforce the laws. Kant was just kind of like, we should either have you know, representative democracy and then a chief executive, or we should have a monarch who writes the laws but then sub executives who enforce them. But either way, he just wants that separation of powers, and that's very Montesquieu kind of position there.
Yeah, and he does dedicate the second, well, like not the second half, but like the last quarter of that essay to praising Frederick the Great of Prussia, the king at his time, for being an enlightened monarch.
Right.
So that's fascinating too, because in other writings he did support representative democracy, but he praises the absolute monarch for being an enlightened despot, basically.
Yeah. It is interesting. I think the important thing to get out of the Enlightenment liberalism is something you brought up and something we mentioned before, is how this universalization and this it starts to go into this idea of the general will or the common good and stuff like that. And you see that even in Smith. Like, even in Smith, though he's focusing on, you know, private property and exchange, he's like, well, this leads to the best outcomes for the most people. So it's kind of a pre-utilitarian kind of thing before Bentham and Mill come along. And Kant talks about that too. Kant talks about how the enlightened despot will make laws that are in line with the general will. And his idea of what the general will is separate from Rousseau, because Rousseau takes a much more directly collectivistic view of it, where Rousseau explicitly says the general will is not the sum of the wills of the individual. It's something different that when they come together. So it's this collectivist, almost metaphysical collectivist kind of thing, where when people come together, the collective can have a will that is different from and even antithetical to the individual wills of the populace. And Kant, I think, rejects that. Kant is like, takes more of the view of the general will as kind of an aggregate of the individual wills of the people, but then you need the enlightened, either representative class or the despot, who can know those things and then put them into effect, because the people, like you said, they're unenlightened and they need somebody to do it for them.
Exactly. And I don't quite agree with any idea of a general will. I think
me neither.
Any abstraction from individual wills is difficult, and not really. You're not going to get an accurate general will anyway, but Rousseau's idea is particularly dumb. I just like to point that out.
Rousseau's the worst.
Kant at least kind of makes sense. It just doesn't play out in practice. Rousseau is just, I can't stand Rousseau's ideas, man.
He's the worst. So I kind of wrote down in my notes that Rousseau is kind of a pre-counter enlightenment kind of guy, and so that now I want to shift into the counter enlightenment as such. And I think that the big thing with the counter enlightenment, we mentioned this briefly before, but I think the big, at least historical motive, was the French Revolution, was the Maistre and those guys looking at what was happening in the French Revolution, and they're just like, guys, you're like, the proof is in the pudding. You are doing something wrong here. Do you think that's a fair explanation of what was going on there, at least historically?
I think that is a fair explanation, but I would add that the other big motivator is the totalitarianism of the 20th century, because that's when the next big wave of counter-enlightenment thought comes, especially Isaiah Berlin, which is somebody I studied a bit more. Because those guys are mostly trying to figure out, like, we thought we had it figured out. The Enlightenment liberals, at least, thought they had it figured out. Mises is not optimistic in 1927 or 1928, whenever he publishes Liberalism. Like he says in one of the final chapters that the whiff of death is in the air for Europe. He senses something coming, and what he sensed was ultimately Hitler's Germany, which Mises eventually has to flee when Hitler invades Austria. And so, a lot of Enlightenment liberals, especially the ones who are truer to the Enlightenment and still held these natural rights views and more egalitarian views, they had no idea this was coming. They did not see the Soviet Union coming at all. They didn't see Hitler's Germany coming at all. And so the counter-Enlightenment, the next wave of it after the people like de Maistre and the response to the French Revolution, the next wave of it is in response to this totalitarianism that took a lot of people by surprise. Like, how did it get so dark so quickly? How did we get here? And that's what Berlin especially tries to answer, I think.
Yeah, for sure. you mentioned Mises and liberalism. And here's an interesting quote that I picked up from it. I remember I read liberalism back in college, probably when I was a junior or senior. And this excerpt stuck with me because I knew that he had written it in 27, and I knew that he had to flee Germany, ultimately flee the Nazis. And it's interesting. I want to read this. Page 51 on the copy I have, which I think you can get on the Mises Institute for free.
Yeah, it's free online. Yeah, that's where I found it.
Yeah, so on the very bottom of page 51, he says, quote, "It cannot be denied that fascism and similar movements aiming at the establishment of dictatorships are full of the best intentions, and that their intervention has, for the moment, saved European civilization. The merit that fascism has thereby won for itself will live on eternally in history. But though its policy has brought salvation for the moment, it is not of the kind which could promise continued success. Fascism was an emergency makeshift. To view it as something more would be a fatal error." So I think this is really interesting, partly because of Mises' own history and the time he was writing this, but also kind of interesting the argument of, you mentioned the 20th century atrocities and how Berlin was responding to those. But so it's like, is it more of the Enlightenment which caused that, or is it more of the counter-Enlightenment that caused that? Because, mm-hmm. you know, the Nazis were all about history, culture, tradition, you know, very, you know, conservative in that sense, but then, you know, politically, economically, very socialist and you know, what we would generally consider left-wing. But then they have this right-wing kind of focus on order and stuff. So
they're reactionaries, like De Maistre was. Yeah.
Right. So is it more the Enlightenment that led to fascism, or is it the counter-Enlightenment that led to fascism, or is it some combination of both?
Right. Well, reflexively, we would like to say that it was the counter-Enlightenment because of all the reasons you listed. But it is important, I think, to consider these counter-Enlightenment liberal arguments, because Isaiah Berlin was a liberal. I don't know his specific political beliefs. I still haven't looked that up. I said I didn't know them on Dissecting Liberty when I talked on there, and I still haven't looked up any of Berlin's specific writings, but I know he was generally considered a liberal, so kind of on Mises' side. And yet, his arguments are pretty convincing still, because it's like I was talking about earlier when I got ahead of myself talking about Kant and his guardian class. It's this idea that you can, if you just have the right people in charge, you can kind of effectively organize society towards one monolithic goal or towards one universal truth. Because if you didn't organize them by force, all the stupid rubes who don't know how to think for themselves would lead us away from that universal truth.
Yeah, men are incapable of self-government. Which is interesting, because if men are incapable of self-government, then how can they be capable of other government, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of the contradiction in all authoritarianism.
Yeah.
And that's what Berlin recognizes, and that's why he's not an authoritarian. And anyway, so you can make the argument that that's where the Nazis were really coming from, was trying to organize German society towards what this... I mean, Nazism did get pretty popular, admittedly. Like, Hitler was elected democratically before he... killed a couple people and seized absolute power at least. But you can argue that that's where the Nazis were coming from, was that they were trying to return Germany to some idealistic view of the past that they had. And that was the true, I don't know the exact word, that was the right goal for Germany as a nation. That was where it should have been. But it wasn't going to get there unless someone seized power and took it there by force. And that's what Hitler was trying to do. And that's exactly what Berlin is talking about. This guiding the minority class towards this universal truth by force. And it's the enlightened despotism. And so that's what he argues the 20th century totalitarianisms are. In fact, he says... the Enlightenment for all the good it did, because he is sympathetic to some Enlightenment thinkers, but he says the Enlightenment for all the good it did eventually ended in the Gulag, and that's his quote. And so he eventually makes the same charge against the Soviets too, and so that's kind of where I am. I'm not exactly sure what position I take on this, to be honest, and I do think that he is pretty convincing though. Especially on the Soviet side, like there was less of a a reactionary vision like DeMaestro, like you're destroying our culture and tradition, whatever. Like the Soviets were destroying the culture and tradition of Russia. That was their explicit goal. The Soviets were more like progressives than reactionaries, and so it's harder to pin them down as counter Enlightenment. But the Nazis were reactionaries, I think, and so it's hard to say Berlin was right, but it's hard to say it was wrong either.
It's interesting because the counter Enlightenment seems to go down this train of cultural relativism, right? Because it's just like each culture has their own thing going on, and they shouldn't, that shouldn't be upended. Order is key, and if you have order with what's going on, then don't go against that. And that ties into postmodernism, right? Because the postmodernists reject reason, they reject the idea of voluntary assent to ideas. Everything is just either oppression or coercion. Even language and discourse to them is simply that. And so it's this kind of anti-humanism, anti-reason, you know, relativistic, it's like, I mean, I think it goes towards nihilism. And, you know, maybe that's a misunderstanding of postmodernism on my part, but it seems pretty nihilistic to me, right? It's just kind of like, or at least pragmatist. I don't know. It's interesting, but it is reactionary. I think that's the right way of putting it. It's very just like they didn't like what they were seeing, and they were just like, guys, this isn't going to work. And then you're right, in the 20th century, with the horrors. But you know, like you said, the Nazis were reactionary as well. So it's like reactionary leading to reactionary, you know, leading to reactionary. it's and that's basically what all philosophy is. I mean, it's there's a very good book. Have you ever heard of Will Durant before?
I don't think I have, no.
So Will Durant was a philosopher and an author. He wrote a book called The Story of Philosophy back in the 1910s or early 1920s, maybe even before that. But it was early 20th century. I think Durant was philosophically a socialist, so I don't think I agree with his philosophy. But he wrote a very good book called The Story of Philosophy, where he just basically goes from Socrates up until, you know, the people like Will James and the pragmatists in America, and he talks about Bertrand Russell even at the end and stuff. But he basically explains kind of philosophers' ideas, but the entire book is like, this is what was happening at this guy's time. This was what his personal life was like, and he looks at their philosophy in that view. So basically, he's always going, the whole point of the book is, what was this guy reacting to? What was going on around him at the time? Why was he saying what he was saying rather than just what he was saying? So that's an interesting book, you know, just came to mind because we're talking about how so much of philosophy, especially recently, has been reactionary and just been going against or in favor of things that came before and are happening at the same time. So it's a good book that's worth looking into to kind of see that the way that philosophy develops. Interesting mix of philosophy and psychology.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned cultural relativism too, because Berlin is often accused of being that. I don't know if he would have called himself that, but as far as I know, he wasn't necessarily, because he does try to come up with an alternate foundation philosophically for what we call libertarianism, what he would have called liberalism. And that is, he says, instead of the Enlightenment view of either natural rights or the Enlightenment view that we can organize society rationally or efficiently based on reason, like come to the proper conclusions about how to organize society based on reason, we should base it on pluralism instead, which is kind of going back to the skepticism you talked about. And that's like, we don't know enough, and so we should give the benefit of the doubt to freedom, because we don't know enough to force people into any one mode of organization. And so that lends itself well to cultural relativism in some ways, but I don't think he necessarily ever says that, like, all cultures or all beliefs are equally valid, anything like that, or because you can still judge them somewhat objectively, but just have skepticism, and ultimately you don't use force to get them to change, to get people to change their practices. And it's a belief that you don't know enough to tell people what they should and shouldn't do, including how society should be organized. And so we should default to freedom is basically his argument as I understand it. And so you can see how the postmodernists would pick that up as him saying there's no absolute truth at all. But I don't think he's necessarily saying that, which is why I kind of sighed. I talked at the very beginning about how there's a dispute between whether he's a postmodernist or not, between some of the modern postmodernist philosophers and the anti-postmodernist philosophers. And I kind of side with the antis on this. I don't think he necessarily is, because he's not necessarily saying that there isn't a universal truth, just that we don't know enough to ever be sure that we have it, and so we should default to freedom, basically just in case, because the alternative is the gulag, like he said. Yeah.
So I want to get into, I should mention before I move on to my next question, that we talked a little bit with Cotton about Deleuze, and I had never heard about Deleuze before. I knew about Derrida, I knew about Foucault, I knew about those guys, but I didn't know about Deleuze, and I've kind of been thinking a lot about the difference between post-structuralism and post-modernism, and what's kind of the difference there, because at least as Cotton explained it to me, and my understanding of what Deleuze was talking about was, this might be totally wrong, I might be totally off base here, but what my understanding of it at this point is that Deleuze basically said that it's not that there's no, you know, universal truths, it's not that these things don't exist, and it's not that the structuralist approach of certain philosophers in the past, it's not that they were necessarily wrong, it's that they were limited in the sense of, just because you set up some, you know, axiom and then deduce from that and come up with these kind of truths, just because that is true doesn't mean it's the whole view of everything, right? And that seems to me to be what Deleuze was kind of pointing out, is just like, yeah, you can have this starting point and you get to some truths, but that's not everything, because over here you can start with this starting point and get to some truths, and then you can kind of put them together. And that doesn't seem to me to be the same as what Foucault and Derrida were doing. I think Foucault and Derrida were like, reason and everything is totally out the window, and it's all just oppression, it's all just power games, it's all just logocentrism. And I mean, as we were saying before, you know, the enlightened despot, I think that there is some reasonable criticism there, but as I said before, I think that just because someone used or tried to use reason and did it incorrectly doesn't mean that reason is totally out the window. And I think that Hoppe showed that, you know, what we were saying before when we brought up Hoppe and his criticism of democracy. So it's
I 100% agree. I don't mean to cut you off, but like, I just want to say I strongly agree with that point. And that's why I'm kind of sympathetic to Berlin. I can't say I'm a counter-enlightenment liberal like him exactly. I honestly don't know enough yet. I'm still working out what exactly I think. And I didn't know that about Deleuze either. I admittedly haven't read enough of Foucault, Derrida, or Deleuze, but that does sound different from what I've heard about Foucault especially.
Yeah.
He's the most I know about. And that seems more of like a just kind of a healthy skepticism that goes farther than what some of the Enlightenment philosophers would have accepted, right, but not necessarily, it's not a bad thing. And it seemed much closer to what Berlin is saying than what Foucault is saying.
Yeah. So, like I said, I could be wrong, right? I've never read Deleuze myself. I've only heard it secondhand. But from my understanding, I think that that's what's going on. I think that's a very fair point, and I think that's totally, totally reasonable,
and completely compatible with libertarianism and the contributions of Mises, Rothbard, Hoppe, all the people we look up to.
Yeah. I think even when we had Kinsella on, he makes a similar point where he says that there's like different justifications for libertarianism. You know, one is the utilitarian argument that free markets and private property will lead to better outcomes, and I think that's basically true. But then there's also the, you know, the natural rights arguments. There's the argumentation ethics argument, and there's these different ways to get to the same conclusion, and they're not one or the other is necessarily better or worse. They're all just kind of dovetailing with each other, and they're different parts of a larger picture. So I think that's totally fair. So we get now to the big question, and I think you talked about this a little bit, and I believe it was what your paper was about, is whether or not enlightenment can be salvaged. And if it can be salvaged, should it be salvaged? And those are the two big questions. So can you speak a little bit to that? Because I think that was kind of what your paper was about, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty much the two big questions I was trying to answer. And well, it wasn't when I started off trying to answer, at least. It was when I found, so I'll pull it up real quick. I have it right in front of me.
Yeah.
So I found this one paper by, what's his name? That's right here in front of me. Oh, Stephen Horwitz, professor of economics at Ball State. He's like somewhat Austrian. He's more of like a Hayekian Austrian, but he's pretty good.
I know who he is. He's from Detroit.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And so he wrote this paper called From Smith to Menger to Hayek, and he draws basically a straight line through the Scottish Enlightenment with its key figure as Adam Smith through to Karl Menger, founder of the Austrian school, and then to Hayek. And he draws it to Hayek instead of Mises, and some people would take issue with that, but I think for his purposes in this paper, it actually works a bit better because what he's talking about is he's not even doing this intentionally necessarily, but with the other stuff I learned about the counter-enlightenment, it starts to make more sense. And basically what he's doing is bolstering the enlightenment against the arguments that Berlin makes without necessarily, you know, it's not like proving Berlin wrong. Like, he makes good points still, but it's a way for the enlightenment to kind of avoid Berlin's criticisms and still be salvaged for liberal / libertarian purposes. And so what he does is he notes the main contributions of each economist, or at least one of the main contributions. Each one made several. So for Smith, he takes the contribution of basically the invisible hand that we recognize that there's well, not necessarily even the invisible hand. He takes the point that we recognize that we can be better off by helping others, and other people recognize that they can be better off by helping us. And that's where Smith gets the invisible hand from, but it's not exactly the same thing. And so the important point there is that we can still act out of self-motivation, but get to a greater social good, like out of self-interest, but still achieve something, you know, mutually beneficial, which seems like a simple point to us who know economics, but it was groundbreaking for Smith. And it's interesting that he still adhered to the labor theory of value when he recognized that. There's a lot of paradoxes in Smith where he like almost gets it right. But anyway, so moving on from Smith, he says Menger basically takes that, and Menger recognizes finally the principle of subjective value. And so he kind of corrects Smith, fixes that little error. And then Menger's big contribution is that out of these mutually beneficial exchanges where people are purely acting in self-interest or mostly acting in self-interest, we can get these social institutions that are the result of human action but not human design, which is something Hayek talks about even more, and we'll get to that in a second. But the example from Menger, the big one, is the institution of money. It's money, according to Menger's account, which is still the standard Austrian account of how money arises, is people acting in self-interest want to get away from a barter economy, because with barter you need just a double coincidence of wants, which means someone else has to have exactly what you want and you have to have exactly what they want in order to make a trade. People want to get away from that because they want to be able to trade what they have to anyone who values it, and then be able to use their income from that trade to buy anything they want. And you don't necessarily have to do that in one trade anymore. If you have a money, a common medium of exchange, then that can facilitate trades with just a single coincidence of wants, basically. You want money, they want your goods, and then you want to give away your goods in order to get money, and so then you can go spend the money on something else. Someone else wants money, and you want their goods, and that's So that's Minger's contribution, is money can arise naturally without being imposed from the top as a social institution, without any one person designing it. No one intended for money to arise. It just happens because of people acting in self-interest, in Smith's conception. And then Hayek continues this by noting that social cooperation and coordination rely on the use of this widely dispersed and highly contextual information that we all have just in our daily lives. And they're just tiny bits and pieces of knowledge, basically, that we all use to make our decisions on a day-to-day basis. But a lot of it isn't even articulable. Like, you can't even say, you can't even put it into words what you know and what you're acting on. You just do it because you know. And so it's subjective in that sense. And it's also extremely, you know, widely dispersed. Like I said, it's basically impossible to condense it all. And even if you could, you couldn't put any of it into words, or you couldn't put a lot of it into words. And so Hayek's contribution is noting that the social institutions that Minger says can arise naturally facilitate, or they are what facilitate this societal use of knowledge. The whole society is able to make use of this knowledge, even though it's widely dispersed and extremely contextual and inarticulable. And we can still make use of it because of these social institutions that Minger said can arise naturally because of the mutually beneficial trades that Smith first identified. So that's the straight line through all of them that Horowitz draws. And this is important for the Enlightenment argument, bringing it all around. Because this is like a rehabilitation of the Enlightenment that's immune to the charges of illiberalism that Berlin accused it of. And that's because Smith identifies that the initial acts of self-interest that lead to these social institutions, which eventually lead to this societal use of knowledge, those actions, those self-interested actions, are essentially a use of reason. It's still the core thread of reason that's part of the Enlightenment is still there. It's just an individual use of reason to recognize that you can be better off by making this exchange or this interaction with another person. And they also use reason to recognize that they can be better off from that exchange. Both people are made better off through the use of reason, because that act is Smith's argument is that act is essentially an act of using reason. And then we get all the way from there to Hayek's conception of making use of the whole body of knowledge in society without anyone directly coordinating it from above. It's kind of similar to the socialist calculation problem, but not quite. And so you still get this Enlightenment belief in reason as an organizing principle of society without it being susceptible to being co-opted by authoritarians who think they can use reason to basically direct a whole society underneath them towards one monolithic goal. Because, as Hayek notes, the knowledge in society is contextual and inarticulable, and no one trying to be in charge of it could ever control it fully, because they can't know all of it. Even a supercomputer couldn't compile all this knowledge and like an AI process it and then use it, because it's not even articulable. The knowledge literally can't be collected. It has to be used socially, and yet it's still used through reason. It's still the organization of society through reason. And that was my argument in this paper, I basically agreed with Horowitz's conclusion and then applied it to the Enlightenment argument. And so if we take this view of the Enlightenment and this view of reason on the individual level, it's no longer susceptible to the enlightened despotism argument and the idea that society can be co-opted and directed toward this monolithic goal, and that resulted in the totalitarianism of the 20th century, like the Nazis and the Soviets. It's a use of reason that isn't susceptible to that anymore.
Fantastic. Yeah, I agree. I think that underscores the point we made before about Mises, with it's part, like you said, it's part of the socialist calculation problem. It's just that there's so much data, there's so much information, and also with the subjective value theory, even if Mises makes this point in Human Action that even if values are only shown in actions, So values rest in the mind, but they're only ever, you can only ever see them in actions. But just because you're acting and that you're revealing that you have some preference for something, that doesn't necessarily show you why you have a preference for that thing. And that's totally different. Two people can do the exact same things, but for, you know, totally different reasons, right? So, yeah, like you said, with the supercomputer. And this is a problem that I have with bioneurologists and other people who think that, well, if we could just get a complex enough brain scan, we could know exactly what somebody's thinking or exactly what they want, they desire. It kind of reminds me of like Peter Joseph, who wants computers allocating all the resources in society.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a very strong argument that there is the thread of reason all throughout, and I think that's the key thing, is that even if the use of the reason by certain people, you know, wasn't totally correct, that doesn't mean that reason itself is totally out of the picture. And to take the reason, to wrench the throne of reason away from the authoritarians and the totalitarians, that's huge. And it addresses both the Enlightenment totalitarianism and the counter-Enlightenment totalitarianism, because it saves the Enlightenment totalitarianism from being the only seat of reason and being able to move everything. And it also saves us from the counter-Enlightenment's entire rejection of reason and just defer to, and you know, the counter-Enlightenment's deferment to tradition, culture, stuff, and the kind of the shift into postmodernism that we've talked about. So yeah, so it's a great thesis, and I think you're totally right. And yeah, I mean the whole libertarian ethic, I think, is just very, you know, logical based, reason based. And so I think it's a huge issue, especially when we're talking about law and other things, because, you know, we need to use reason to come up with ways to resolve conflicts. And, you know, that's just what Hoppe and other people talk about, is who owns what, who has the better claim. And we have to use reason and evidence to make those arguments and to do that. So I think that, especially Hoppe's argumentation ethics, I think that reason and argumentation is the only way we can get rid of disputes. So so reason can lead to the bad totalitarianism and violence and stuff, but that doesn't mean that reason also isn't the way to stop it. It's just, it needs better reason and better arguments. So yeah, to throw it out entirely, I think is a huge mistake. And I think in today, you know, with the crazy leftist, you know, all this stuff where it's just no truth and this and that, I mean, it's really dangerous, because when there's no truth, any despot can come in and just, they don't have to justify anything they're saying, right? It's just like, well, if it's all just power games and I have more power, and that's it, bro. So
yeah, exactly.
Well, great. I think we solved every problem there is about the Enlightenment. You now know everything there is to know. You never have to ask another question about the Enlightenment ever again. Because
this hour and a half has put an end to all debates ever. No one has to discuss that era of literary and philosophical history ever again.
Because the philosopher kings, David and Porter, have solved it all for you. All right, Porter. Well, thank you so much. This has been fun. Want to say anything, give some plugs or any final comments before we wrap it up?
Yeah, just thank you for having me on and letting me rant about this again. It was fun on Dissecting Liberty the first time, and I don't think I got to say everything I wanted to. Now I can't imagine what else I would say, so thank you so much for that.
So glad to help.
And yeah, just follow me on Twitter. That's where I'm most active now, at Mind Your Excuses, no spaces between the words or anything. Just, all one username. And yeah, that's pretty much all I'm doing right now. Also, the Insurrection Inc. podcast, be sure to go check that out. Still doing that. So yeah, that's all I got. Thank you again.
All right, yeah, thank you, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.